With a jerry-built sextant and their wristwatches, they timed the angular motion of the setting sun. It was 360 degrees in 24 hours, Earth standard. Before the sun got too low in the horizon, they disassembled Ellie's camera and used the lens to start a fire. She kept the frond by her side, fearful that someone would carelessly throw it on the flames after dark. She proved to be an expert firemaker. He positioned them upwind and kept the fire low. Gradually, the stars came out. They were all there, the familiar constellations of Earth. She volunteered to stay up a while, tending the fire while the others slept. She wanted to see Lyra rise. The night was exceptionally clear, and Vega shone steady and brilliant. From the apparent motion of the constellations across the sky, from the southern hemisphere constellations that she could make out, and from the Big Dipper lying near the northern horizon, she deduced that they were in tropical latitudes. If all this is a simulation, she thought before falling asleep, they've gone to a great deal of trouble. Ellie awoke with a sense of disorientation so profound it bordered on vertigo. Where was she? Wisconsin, Puerto Rico, New Mexico, Wyoming, Hokkaido. And she remembered. It was unclear, to within 30,000 light-years, where in the Milky Way galaxy she was. Probably the all-time record for disorientation. Despite a headache, Ellie laughed, and Devi, sleeping beside her, stirred. They could hear shouting from farther up the beach. The three men were waving and beckoning. Ellie and Devi roused themselves and joined them. Standing upright on the sand was a door. A wooden door, with paneling and a brass doorknob. It was set in two jambs, a lintel and a threshold. It was in no way extraordinary for Earth. She said, "Now go around to the back." From the back, the door was not there at all. Ellie could see Ada and Vega and she, Devi standing a little apart, and the sand continuous between the four of them and her. She moved to the side, her heels moistened by the surf, and she could make out a single dark razor-thin vertical line. She was reluctant to touch it. Returning to the back again, she satisfied herself that there were no shadows or reflections in the air before her, and then stepped through. Ada laughed.
"Bravo!
What did you see when I walked towards you?"
"A lovely woman strolling through a closed door 2 centimeters thick."
"Have you tried to open it?"
"Not yet."
Vega was studying the door.
"It looks like something by... what's the name of that French surrealist?"
René Magritte. He was Belgian. Devi gestured toward the beach and sky.
"We're agreed, I take it, that this isn't really the Earth."
Ellie laughed.
"Unless we're in the Persian Gulf 3,000 years ago and there are djinns about."
"What do you think would happen if we opened the door and walked in?" She said.
"If we are here to be tested, on the other side is probably the test, maybe one for each of us."
He was ready. She wished she were.
Wordlessly, they regarded one another. Ada doffed his cap, made a slight but graceful bow, turned and approached the door.
Ellie ran to him and kissed him on both cheeks. He opened the door, entered, and disappeared into thin air. With the door ajar, there had seemed to be only the continuation of beach and surf behind him. The door closed. She ran around it, but there was no trace of Ada. She was next. Ellie found herself struck by how docile they had been. They could have told us where they were taking us and what all this was for, she thought. It could have been part of the message or information conveyed after the machine was activated. They could have told us we were docking with a simulation of a beach on Earth. They could have told us to expect the door. They had invented the language introduced in the message primer. Why not use it? Vega saw her staring at the closed door and asked if she wished to enter next.
Vega, I've been thinking. I know it's a little crazy, but it just struck me.
Why do we have to jump through every hoop that they hold out for us? Suppose we don't do what they ask.
Ellie, you are so American. For me, this is just like home. I'm used to doing what the authorities suggest, especially when I have no choice.
He smiled and turned smartly on his heel. High above, a gull squawked. Vega had left the door ajar. There was still only beach beyond. Devi asked her,
"Are you all right? Seriously, I'm asking as a doctor. Do you feel all right?"
"I woke up with a headache, and I think I had some very fanciful dreams. I haven't brushed my teeth or had my black coffee.
Except for that, really, I'm fine.
Well, that sounds all right. For the matter, I have a bit of a headache, too.
Take care of yourself, Ellie. Remember everything so you'll be able to tell it to me next time we meet.
I will. They kissed, Debbie stepped over the threshold, and vanished. The door closed behind her. Ellie thought she caught a whiff of curry. Ellie was alone. Carefully, she brushed accumulated sand off the microcamera system and its tiny arsenal of video cassettes on which she had recorded wonders. She tried to imagine thousands of comparable chambers, simulated worlds, whatever these were, each a meticulous copy of the nicest part of someone's home planet. Thousands of them, each with sky and weather, ocean, geology, and indigenous life indistinguishable from the originals. It seemed an extravagance, although it also suggested that a satisfactory outcome was within reach. No matter what your resources, you don't manufacture a landscape on this scale for 5 specimens from a doomed world. On the other hand, the idea of extraterrestrials as zookeepers had become something of a cliché. What if this sizable station, with its profusion of docking ports and environments, was actually a zoo? See the exotic animals in their native habitats? Tourists would come from all over the galaxy, especially during school vacations. There was not a sail on the horizon. A few seagulls were stalking the beach, apparently looking for crabs. She wished she had some bread to give them. She inspected their doorway again. She felt a continuing reluctance to enter. More than reluctance, maybe dread. She withdrew, keeping the door in view. Beneath a palm tree, her knees drawn up under her chin, she looked out over the long sweep of white sandy beach. She wondered about the others. Were they now in some outlandish testing facility, avidly checking away on the multiple-choice questions? Or was it an oral examination? And who were the examiners? She felt the uneasiness well up once again. Another intelligent being, independently evolved in some distant world, under unearthly physical conditions, and with an entirely different sequence of random genetic mutations. Such a being would not resemble anyone she knew, or even imagined. If this was a test station, then there were station masters, and the station masters would be thoroughly, devastatingly non-human. There was something deep within her that was bothered by insects, snakes, star-nosed moles. She worried that she would be unable even to confront, much less to win over for the human species, an extraterrestrial being. There had been no effort to determine whether the 5 were afraid of mice or dwarves or Martians. She wondered why they hadn't thought of it. It seemed an obvious enough point now. It had been a mistake to send her. Perhaps when confronted with some serpent-haired station master, she would disgrace herself, or far worse, tip the grade given to the human species in whatever unfathomable test was being administered from pass to fail. She looked with both apprehension and longing at the enigmatic door, its lower boundary now underwater. The tide was coming in. There was a figure on the beach a few hundred meters away. At first she thought it was Vege, perhaps out of the examining room early and come to tell her the good news. But whoever it was wasn't wearing a machine project jumpsuit. Also, it seemed to be someone younger. She reached for the long lens and for some reason hesitated. Standing up, she shielded her eyes from the sun. Just for a moment, it had seemed, it was clearly impossible. They would not take such shameless advantage of her. But she could not help herself. She was racing toward him on the hard sand near the water's edge, her hair streaming behind her. He looked as she remembered him, vigorous, happy. She flew into his arms, sobbing. "Hello, Presh." He stroked her hair. His voice was right. She instantly remembered it, and his smell, his gait, his laugh, the way his beard braided her cheek— all of it combined to shatter her self-possession. She could feel a massive stone seal being pried open and the first rays of light entering an ancient, almost forgotten tomb. She swallowed and tried to gain control of herself, but seemingly inexhaustible waves of anguish poured out of her and she would weep again. He stood there patiently. She cried for all the years between herself and him. In her girlhood and as a young woman, she would dream that he had come to her and told her that his death had been a mistake. He was really fine. But she would pay for those brief respites with poignant reawakenings into a world in which he no longer was. And now here he was, not a dream or a ghost, but flesh and blood. Close enough. He had called to her from the stars, and she had come. She hugged him with all her might. She knew it was a trick, a reconstruction simulation, but it was flawless. For a moment she held him by the shoulders at arm's length. It was as if her father had these many years ago died and gone to heaven, and finally she had managed to rejoin him. She sobbed and embraced him again, then wiped her eyes, laughing and crying at once. So what do I owe this apparition to? Robotics or hypnosis? Am I an artifact or a dream? You might ask that about anything. Even today, not a week goes by when I don't think that I'd give anything, anything, just to spend a few minutes with my father again. Well, here I am. He raised his hands, making a half turn so she could be sure that the back of him was there as well. But he was so young. He had been only 36 when he died. Maybe this was their way of calming her fears. If so, they were very thoughtful. She guided him back toward her few possessions, her arm around his waist. He certainly felt substantial enough. If there were gear trains and integrated circuits underneath his skin, they were well hidden. So, how are we doing? I mean, I know. It took you many years from receipt of the message to your arrival here. Do you grade on speed or accuracy? Neither. You mean we haven't completed the test yet? He did not answer. Well, explain it to me. Some of us have spent years decrypting the message and building the machine. Aren't you going to tell me what it's all about? You've become a real scrapper. He spoke as if he really were her father, as if he were comparing his last recollections of her with her present, still incompletely developed self. He gave her hair an affectionate tousle. She remembered that from childhood also. But how could they, 30,000 light-years from Earth, how could they know her father's affectionate gestures in long-ago and far-away Wisconsin? Suddenly she knew. Dreams. Last night, when we were all dreaming, you were inside our heads, right? You drained everything we know. We only made copies. I think everything that used to be in your head is still there. Take a look. Tell me if anything's missing. He grinned and went on. There was so much your television programs didn't tell us. Oh, we could figure out your technological level pretty well and a lot more about you. But there's so much more to your species than that. Things we couldn't possibly learn indirectly. I recognize you may feel some breach of privacy, but we have so little time. You mean the test is over? We answered all your questions while we were asleep last night? So did we pass or fail? It isn't like that. Don't think of us as some interstellar sheriff gunning down outlaw civilizations. Think of us more as the Office of the Galactic Census. We collect information. I know you think nobody has anything to learn from you because you're technologically so backward. But there are other merits to a civilization. What merits? Oh, music, loving-kindness, dreams. Humans are very good at dreaming, although you'd never know it from your television. There are cultures all over the galaxy that trade dreams. You operate an interstellar cultural exchange? That's what this is all about? You don't care if some rapacious, bloodthirsty civilization develops interstellar spaceflight? I said we admire loving-kindness. If the Nazis had taken over the world, our world, and then developed interstellar spaceflight, wouldn't you have stepped in? You'd be surprised how rarely something like that happens. In the long run, the aggressive civilizations destroy themselves, almost always. It's their nature. They can't help it. In such a case, our job would be to leave them alone, to make sure that no one bothers them, to let them work out their destiny. Then why didn't you leave us alone? I'm not complaining, mind you. I'm only curious as to how the Office of the Galactic Census works. The first thing you picked up from us was that Hitler broadcast. Why did you make contact? The picture, of course, was alarming. We could tell you were in deep trouble. But the music told us something else. The Beethoven told us there was hope. Marginal cases are our specialty. We thought you could use a little help. Really, we can offer only little. You understand? There are certain limitations imposed by causality. He had crouched down, running his hands through the water, and was now drying them on his pants. Last night we looked inside you. All five of you. There's a lot in there. You're an interesting mix. All that in one night's work? We had to hurry. We have a pretty tight schedule.
Why, is something about to...
No. It's just that if we don't engineer a consistent causality, it'll work itself out on its own. Then it's almost always worse. She had no idea what he meant. What a nice pendant. He spoke with just that air of fatherly reserve she imagined he would have cultivated had he lived to see her adolescence. Who gave it to you? She fingered the medallion. Actually, it's from somebody I don't know very well. He tested my faith. But you must know all this already. He grinned. She felt a little annoyed. I want to know what you think of us. What do you really think? He did not hesitate for a moment. All right, I think it's amazing that you've done as well as you have. You've got hardly any theory of social organization, astonishingly backward economic systems, no grasp of the machinery of historical prediction, and very little knowledge about yourselves. Considering how fast your world is changing, it's amazing you haven't blown yourself to bits by now. That's why we don't want to write you off just yet. You humans have a certain talent for adaptability, at least in the short term.
That's the issue, isn't it?
That's one issue. You can see that after a while, the civilizations with only short-term perspectives just aren't around. They work out their destinies also. She wanted to ask him how he honestly felt about humans. Curiosity? Compassion? No feelings? Whatever? In his heart of hearts, or whatever equivalent internal organs he possessed, did he think of her as she thought of an ant? But she could not bring herself to raise the question. She was too much afraid of the answer. From the intonation of his voice, from the nuances of his speech, she tried to gain some glimpse of who it was here disguised as her father. She had an enormous amount of direct experience with human beings. The station masters had less than a day's. Could she not discern something of their true nature beneath this amiable and informative facade? But she couldn't. In the content of his speech, he was, of course, not her father, nor did he pretend to be. But in every other respect, he was uncannily close to Theodore F. Arroway, 1924 to 1960, vendor of hardware, loving husband, and father. Part of her kept wanting to ask him how things had been since he'd gone to heaven. Was anything special in the works for the millennium? There were human cultures that taught an afterlife of the blessed on mountaintops or in clouds, in caverns or oases, but she could not recall any in which, if you were very, very good, when you died, you went to the beach. Do you have time for some questions before whatever it is we have to do next?
Sure. One or two, anyway.
Tell me about your transportation system.
I can do better than that. I can show you. Steady now.
An amoeba of blackness leaked out from the zenith, obscuring the sun and blue sky. She gasped.
Oh, that's quite a trick.
The same sandy beach was beneath her feet. She dug her toes in. Overhead was the cosmos. They were, it seemed, high above the Milky Way galaxy, looking down on its spiral structure and falling toward it at some impossible speed. He explained matter-of-factly, using her own familiar scientific language to describe the vast pinwheel-shaped structure. He showed her the Orion spiral arm, in which the sun was in this epoch embedded. Interior to it were the Sagittarius arm, the Normus scutum arm, and the 3 kiloparsec arm. A network of straight lines appeared, representing the transportation system they had used. It was like the illuminated maps in the Paris metro. Ada had been right. Each station, she deduced, was in a star system with a low-mass double black hole. She knew the black holes couldn't have resulted from stellar collapse, from the normal evolution of massive star systems, because they were too small. Maybe they were primordial, left over from the Big Bang, captured by some unimaginable starship and towed to their designated station. Or maybe they were made from scratch. She wanted to ask about this, but the tour was pressing breathlessly onward. There was a disk of glowing hydrogen rotating about the center of the galaxy, and within it a ring of molecular clouds rushing outward toward the periphery of the Milky Way. He showed her the ordered motions in the giant molecular cloud complex Sagittarius B2, which had for decades been a favorite hunting ground for complex organic molecules by her radioastronomical colleagues on Earth. Closer to the center, they encountered another giant molecular cloud, and then Sagittarius A West, an intense radio source that Ailey herself had observed at Argus. And just adjacent, at the very center of the galaxy, locked in a passionate gravitational embrace, was a pair of immense black holes. The mass of one of them was 5 million suns. Rivers of gas the size of solar systems were pouring down its maw. So two supermassive black holes are orbiting one another at the center of the galaxy. One had been known, or at least strongly suspected, but two. Shouldn't that have shown up as a Doppler displacement of spectral lines? She imagined a sign under one of them reading, "Entrance," and under the other, "Exit." Surrounding stars, gas and dust were being eaten up by the entrance black hole, and that was where this station, Grand Central, was, just safely outside the black holes at the center of the galaxy. "It goes somewhere, right?"
"Right."
"Can you tell me where?"
"Sure. All this stuff winds up in Cygnus A."
Except only for a nearby supernova remnant in Cassiopeia, Cygnus A was the brightest radio source in the skies of Earth. She had calculated that in 1 second, Cygnus A produces more energy than the sun does in 40,000 years. The radio source was 600 million light-years away from Earth, far beyond the Milky Way. As with many extragalactic radio sources, two enormous jets of gas, fleeing apart at almost the speed of light, were making a complex web of Ronquin-Hugoniot shock fronts with the thin intergalactic gas and producing in the process a radio beacon that shone brightly over most of the universe. All the matter in this enormous structure, 500,000 light-years across, was pouring out of a tiny, almost inconspicuous point in space exactly midway between the jets. "You're making Cygnus A?" She half remembered a summer's night in Michigan when she was a girl. She had feared she would fall into the sky.
"Oh, it's not just us. This is a cooperative project of many galaxies. That's what we mainly do. Engineering. Only a few of us are involved with emerging civilizations."
At each pause, she had felt a kind of tingling in her head. "There are cooperative projects between galaxies? Lots of galaxies, each with a kind of central administration, with hundreds of billions of stars in each galaxy, and then those administrations cooperate to pour millions of suns into Cygnus A. Forgive me, I'm just staggered by the scale. Why would you do all this, whatever for?"
"You mustn't think of the universe as a wilderness. It hasn't been that for billions of years. Think of it more as cultivated."
Again a tingling. "But what for? What's there to cultivate?"
"The basic problem is easily stated. Now, don't get scared off by the scale. You're an astronomer, after all. The problem is that the universe is expanding, and there's not enough matter in it to stop the expansion. After a while, no new galaxies, no new stars, no new planets, no newly arisen life forms, just the same old crowd. Everything's getting run down. It'll be boring. So in Cygnus A, we're testing out the technology to make something new. You might call it an experiment in urban renewal. It's not our only trial run. Sometime later, we might want to close off a piece of the universe and prevent space from getting more and more empty as the eons pass. Increasing the local matter density is the way to do it, of course. It's good, honest work."
Like running a hardware store in Wisconsin. If Cygnus A was 600 million light-years away, then astronomers on Earth, or anywhere in the Milky Way for that matter, were seeing it as it had been 600 million years ago. But on Earth, 600 million years ago, she knew, there had been hardly any life, even in the ocean. They were old. You've been pouring matter into Cygnus A for the last 600 million years? Well, what you've detected by radio astronomy was just some of our early feasibility testing. We're much further along now. And in due course, in another few hundred million years, she imagined, radio astronomers on Earth, if any, will detect substantial progress in the reconstruction of the universe around Cygnus A. She steeled herself for further revelations and vowed she would not let them intimidate her. There was a hierarchy of beings on a scale she could not have imagined, but the Earth had a place, a significance in that hierarchy. They would not have gone to all this trouble for nothing. The blackness rushed back to the zenith and was consumed. Sun and blue sky returned. The scene was the same: surf, sand, palms, Magritte d'Or, microcamera, Frond, and her father. You built it all? The subways, I mean, you and those other engineers from other galaxies. Oh, no, we haven't built any of it. I've missed something. Help me understand. We emerged a long time ago on many different worlds in the Milky Way. The first of us developed interstellar spaceflight, and eventually chanced on one of the transit stations. Of course, we didn't know what it was. We weren't even sure it was artificial until the first of us were brave enough to slide down. Who's we? You mean the ancestors of your race, your species? No, no. We're many species from many worlds. Eventually, we found a large number of subways, various ages, and all abandoned. Most were still in good working condition. All we did was make some repairs and improvements. No other artifacts, no dead cities, no records of what happened, no subway builders left? He shook his head. No industrialized abandoned planets? There was a galaxy-wide civilization that picked up and left without leaving a trace except for the stations. That's more or less right. And it's the same in other galaxies also. Billions of years ago, they all went somewhere. We haven't the slightest idea where. But where could they go? He shook his head for the third time, but now very slowly. So, you're not? No. We're just caretakers. Maybe someday, they'll come back. Okay, just one more question. All right, but we only have a few minutes left. I want to know about your myths, your religions. What fills you with awe? Or are those who make the numinous unable to feel it? You make the numinous also. No, I know what you're asking. Certainly we feel it. You recognize that some of this is hard for me to communicate to you, but I'll give you an example of what you're asking. I don't say this is it exactly, but it'll give you a... He paused momentarily, and again she felt a tingle. Had he missed something last night? If so, she was glad. It meant they weren't perfect. A flavor of our numinous. It concerns pi, the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. You know it well, of course, and you also know you can never come to the end of pi. There's no last digit, only an infinite number of digits. Your mathematicians have made an effort to calculate it out to... None of you seem to know. Let's say the 10 billionth place. You won't be surprised to hear that other mathematicians have gone further. Well, eventually. Let's say it's in the 10 to the 20th power place. Something happens. The randomly varying digits disappear, and for an unbelievably long time, there is nothing but ones and zeros. Idly, he was tracing a circle on the sand with his toe. She paused a heartbeat before replying. And the zeros and ones finally stop? You get back to a random sequence of digits? Seeing a faint sign of encouragement, she raced on. And the number of zeros and ones, is it a product of prime numbers? Yes, 11 of them. You're telling me there's a message in 11 dimensions hidden deep inside the number pi? Someone in the universe communicates by mathematics. But... Help me, I'm really having trouble understanding you. Mathematics isn't arbitrary. I mean, pi has to have the same value everywhere. How can you hide a message inside pie? It's built into the fabric of the universe.
Exactly.
She stared at him.
It's even better than that. Let's assume that only in base 10 arithmetic does the sequence of zeros and ones show up, although you'd recognize that something funny's going on in any other arithmetic. Let's also assume that the beings who first made this discovery had 10 fingers. You see? It's as if Pi has been waiting billions of years for 10-fingered mathematicians with fast computers to come along. The message was kind of addressed to us.
But this is just a metaphor, right? It's not really Pi in the 10 to the 20th place. You don't actually have 10 fingers.
Not really.
He smiled at her. Well, for heaven's sake, what does the message say? He paused for a moment, raised and then pointed to the door. A small crowd of people was excitedly pouring out of it. They were in a jovial mood, as if this were a long-delayed picnic outing. Ada was accompanying a stunning young woman. From photographs, Ellie recognized her as his wife. Sukhavati was holding hands with an earnest young man, his eyes large and soulful. Ellie assumed it was Surinder Ghosh, Devi's long-dead medical student husband. She was in animated discourse with a small, vigorous man of commanding demeanor. He had drooping, wispy mustaches and was garbed in a richly brocaded and beaded gown. Vege ushered over a girl of 11 or 12, her blonde braids bobbing as she walked.
This is my granddaughter, Nina, more or less. I should have introduced you before. In Moscow, I have not been a very good father to her mother. These days I hardly see Nina at all.
Ellie embraced the girl. Seeing his tenderness toward Nina, Ellie decided she liked him more than ever. She looked around her. The station masters had produced for each of the five their deepest loves. Perhaps it was to ease the barriers of communication with another appallingly different species. The caretakers were in a polite but determined hurry. There was not much time to talk. The entrance to the airlock of the dodecahedron was now visible, roughly where it had been when they first arrived. The Magritte doorway had vanished. Everyone introduced everyone, and they all solemnly shook hands. Her father said gently,
"Time to go home."
It was wrenching. She didn't want to go. She tried asking more questions. "How do you mean, home? You mean we're going to emerge somewhere in the solar system? How will we get down to Earth?"
"You'll see. It'll be interesting."
He put his arm around her waist, guiding her toward the open airlock door. She tried another question. "The Earth is linked up now, right? Both ways. If we can go home, you can come down to us. You know, that makes me awfully nervous. Why don't you just sever the link? We'll take it from here."
"Sorry, Presh. For a while, at least, it'll be open only to inbound traffic, but we don't expect to use it."
She would have preferred a 52-year leeway between unacceptable behavior on Earth and the arrival of a punitive expedition. No matter what assurances they gave, they would watch us more closely now. "You've been very generous in answering all of my questions. Can I answer any for you?"
"Thanks. You've answered all our questions last night."
"That's it? No commandments, no instructions for the provincials?"
"It doesn't work that way, Presh. You're grown up now. You're on your own." He tilted his head, gave her that grin, and she flew into his arms, her eyes again filling with tears.
She took one last look at the seashore at the center of the galaxy. A pair of seabirds, petrels, remained aloft with hardly a beat of their wings. Just at the entrance to the airlock, she turned and called to him. "What does your message say?
The one in Pi." "We don't know. We're still working on it."
The breeze stirred up, tossing her hair once again. "Well, give us a call when you figure it out."